begin this evening, B'Sha'a Tova, I think it is our 16th cycle of the Chumash year. And Baruch Hashem, we've seen a great many things, and still much more to see. I was talking with my youngest son just on Simchas Torah. I told him that on the Chag of Simchas Torah, so we do two things. We read the end of the Torah, Vazos HaBracha, and then straight away we start again, Parshas Bereishis. And he was very impressed by that. And he noted that probably the second time around is much quicker. But I believe we have found the opposite to be true. Parshas Noach, of course, Bereishis and Noach between them account for a great proportion of our history. And the parsha of Noach begins in a very distressing state. The world, as was known then, was to be destroyed, almost everybody with it. And the exception is Noach. And Noach has to make a teva, and that's how he will survive. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him the dimensions of the teva in Perek Vav, Pasuk, Ches Vav. Vizeh Asher Ta'aseh Osa. This is how you should make the teva. Shalosh Meos Amo Orech HaTeva, 300 Amos long. Chamishim Amo Rochba, 50 Amos wide. Shloshim Amo Komosa, 30 Amos high. Very specific dimensions. Of course, being Jewish, we need to ask, why is it that size? Why does it have to be 300? Why 50 wide? And of course, the question is accentuated when we bear in mind the words of the Ramban, that there is no way in the world, naturally, that all of the species of the animal kingdom and the birds and all of that could naturally fit into an area that is 300 by 50 wide. Cannot be. Even if the Amos are Shir Chazonish. And therefore, says the Ramban, there is no question that it was a miraculous occurrence. That said, if it's a miracle, of course, then the question will now move to the other side. So then why make a teva at all? The answer, of course, is you do what you can. You have to do something. That the Ramban says. But once we appreciate that in terms of what is necessary, this is not big enough. But you have to do something. Therefore, the question lands at the point, why is the something exactly so precise? 300 by 50 by 30. And there is a most fascinating answer to this question, which is to be found in the Perush of the Malbim. The Malbim, generally speaking, is well known for explaining the Chumash al derech hapshat. That is his area of expertise. That said, there is very little to say al derech hapshat here, because al derech ha-normalcy, the size of the teva is neither here nor there. And therefore, says the Malbim, we need to understand that something else is going on. It's interesting to note that the way in which Noah was saved was through a teva, was through an ark. One could imagine there would be any number of ways to save him. But actually what is happening is that the existence of the world around Noah is actually coming to a halt. And the world, in terms of meaningful existence, actually will start again with Noach. The human race are called B'nai Noach, not B'nai Adam. And therefore, the way that Noach is contained, or the a setting for Noah during this year is actually the seed for a new world. Says the Malbim, there are two names that we use referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a creative capacity in terms of specifically creation of the world. There is the Shem Havaya, Yudke Vavke, which derives really from the word Havaya, which is existence. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the source of existence, who bestows existence to everything else. As creator of the world and then master of the world, which is the name of Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. Mastery, as we say, Adon Olam. It is the combination of these two names that represent the forces that will recreate the world with Noah. And they represent the world of Noah during this year. Now, when these names are combined and fused, the way that that will be expressed is by taking the four letters of Yud, He, Vav, and He, and combining that is to say, to multiply them, to get the product of these four letters with the four letters of Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. And when we do, we will see something most interesting. The height of the Teva, which is 30 high, is so, because the top 10 amos are for human habitat, which is ultimately what it's all about, and then the lower two are for the animals, and therefore the food and the refuse and the like. And thus, the first critical dimension are the 10 amos where Noah and his family will live. And that is derived by beginning at the beginning. If we start with the beginning of Shem Havaya is the letter Yud, and we cross that with the beginning of Aleph Dalet, which is Aleph. So Yud is 10. Aleph, of course, is 1. 10 times 1 is 10. And they are the top 10 Amos. Moving along to the second in each series. So the second in Yud, Kei, Vav, Kei is the He, which is 5. And cross that with the Dalet of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. Dalet is 4. The 5 times 4 is 20. And that gives us the lower 20 amos. So thus we have the entire height accounted for. Moving on to the third letter in the names. So the third letter of the Shem Havaya is Yud Kei Vav, which is 6. Crossing with Aleph Dalet Nun. Nun is 50. And 6 times 50 is 300. That's the length of the Teva. Then the final letter of Yud Kei Vav Kei, which is He, crossed with the Yud at the end of the Shem of Adnus, which is 10, 5 times 10 is 50, that's the width of the Teva. And so, what we have actually is Noah is living really in an environment which is a representation of the forces with which the new world will be created. It's most interesting to note that it may well be that this understanding and explanation of the Malbim is referred to or alluded to by the Zohar HaKadosh. Because the Zohar, with reference to the Teva, adduces a most interesting pasuk. It's a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk states, Migdol Oz Shem Hashem. Migdol Oz, Tower of Strength, Shem Hashem, is the name of God. Bo Yoros Tzadik, the Tzadik should run there, V'niskav, and he will be saved. Says the Zohar, Do Tevusa. That's the Teva. So most of the pasuk, I think we understand. It's a fortress for Noah. He runs there to be saved. But the Zohar has identified the essence of the Teva as per the beginning of the pasuk, Migdol Oz, Shem Hashem. The tower actually is a product of the name of God, as is elaborated upon by the Malbim. So this is a very interesting approach to understand the specifics. And the Torah is specific. It's not left to Noah. The length and the height and the width are all given to him by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is the most interesting insight as to why that is the case. Now, I'd like to move from here, actually, to a point post the Mabul. It's one of the most interesting and, dare I say, colorful aspects of the Parsha, And that is the rainbow. For in Perek Tes, Pasuk Ches, let us see what insight this Os Baris, the sign of the rainbow, gives us to life before, during, and after the Mabul. So it begins in Perek Tes, Pasuk Ches, Vayomer Elokim al Noach ve'el banav ito lemor. Hashem says to Noach and to his sons, and here, interestingly, I wonder whether it's material for what's to come, but there is a machlokus rishonim, there is discussion amongst the early authorities as to what exactly the pasuk ches means when it says that Hashem spoke to Noach and his sons with him. Does that mean he spoke to all four of them? Could that be? Perhaps. As we know, the three sons of Noach were not homogeneous at all in terms of their spiritual standing. You have Shem on the one hand, who is, of course, he is Shem. From him comes Avram. Yefes is kind of in the middle. And Ham picks up the rear. He's somewhat deficient in moral fiber, as we know. And nonetheless, the Pasuk seems to be saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to all of them. It could be that for all of his faults, even Ham, together with the sons of Noach, having gone through the experience of the year in the Teva, were worthy of some type of prophetic experience. Perhaps, as long as they're together with Noach, sometimes it works that way, that the spirit that descends upon the one who is worthy can sometimes spill over to his environs. And thus the Pasuk says, Hashem spoke to Noach and to his sons with him. The Ramban, however, insists that El Banavito means Hashem spoke to Noach, and Noach was the one who passed the message on to his sons. The only one who heard it was Noach. And that is actually an interesting question that persists in the Chumash. For there is a large discussion amongst the Mefarshim over the numerous times that we find in the Chumash that Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron. And again, the question comes out, does that mean that Aaron was party to the original message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or perhaps he was the first one to hear from Moshe? That's a broader parshanut question. But what is the message here? Well, we have the bris, which is pasuk tes, va'ani hinani mekim es brisi itchem ve'zarachem achareichem. There will be a covenant. The covenant is not to bring another marble. And that covenant is sealed with an os bris, which is to be found in pasuk yud gimel. Es kashti nasati be'anan. The keshes, the rainbow, is in the clouds, will be in the clouds. The haisal os baris beini uvein haaretz, and that will be the sign of the covenant. Now, the Ramban raises a simple question. For the straightforward translation of the words would seem to imply that with the bris that came after the Mabul came a new phenomenon into the world, which is called a rainbow. Ask the Ramban, are we to be given to understand that for the first 1500 and however many years of the history of the world, there was never a rainbow? The background, of course, to his question, as he expresses it, is that as much as a rainbow, it looks, it's very striking and it looks very nice, but it happens to be the product of the light of the sun, as is refracted and then reflected from the moisture in the air post the rainfall. And it's something that can happen at any time. All you need is rain and sun. You get a rainbow. Are we to understand that there was no such condition? That the first rainbow ever to be seen was in this setting? That means that there were unnatural conditions initially. But how and why would that be so? And based on this question, the Ramban indeed concludes that that is not the case. Rather, the Pasuk does not mean to say that there is a new phenomenon being introduced to the world called a rainbow that was never seen before, but here it is, and here this is what it represents. Not at all. It may well be that it existed before. It is being enlisted at this stage as an os baris. It is the most meaningful and relevant entity in the world to become what represents what the bris is about. Says Ramban, not every os bris comes into existence as the bris itself does. For example, we find in the end of Parshas Vayetze, Yaakov makes a bris with Lavan, a non-aggression pact. And they seal it with an os bris. What's the os bris? A pile of stones? Gal Eid, Yagar Sadusa. Says Ramban, we can be quite sure that all of those stones pre-existed the bris. But they never had the capacity of an os bris until the bris happened, and then they were brought in. And in fact, says Ramban, if we look carefully at the phraseology, if we read the psukim carefully, we will see that this really seems to be explicit in the pasuk. For have a look at pasuk Yud Beis. Vayomer Elokim, Zos os habris asher ani nosein beni uveinichem. This is the sign of the covenant that I am giving, which is in the present tense, meaning I am now giving you this os bris. Okay. Next pasuk Yud Gimel, eskashti, the rainbow, nosati be'anan. That's in the past. And then goes on to say, v'haysa the os bris, and it will be os bris. Says Ramban, we see clearly from here that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying that this is not the first rainbow. There have been many rainbows before. Eskashti nasati ba'anan. Prior to today, it was called a rainbow. Subsequent to today, it will take on another capacity, which is called the os bris. The question is, if it's not invented or created specifically to represent the bris that exists already, and it was pulled out of any number of natural phenomena, so now the question is, Ma inyan keshes eitzel noach? Why of all things in the world does this phenomena become volunteered as the os bris for Noach? Says Ramban, there is something about the nature of the rainbow, specifically the shape of the rainbow, that makes it an ideal, appropriate sign of the covenant. For what is the covenant about? It basically, in simple terminology, Hashem is saying, I will never again destroy the world through a marble. A keshes, as we know, a bow, is an instrument of war. That instrument was directed against the world during the time of the marble. The rainbow is directed away from the world. Says the Ramban, it is the way of those who come towards each other with an overture of peace to reverse their weapons. To turn them round, as if to say, there will be no aggression. And therefore, the keshes, which is actually, it has the bow shape, but the bow is turned away from the world, that's a sign of peace from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Additionally, says the Ramban, what's interesting about the keshes is, as an instrument of war, it would be useless because there is no string. All that exists is the bow part. And a bow without the string has basically been dismantled. And once again, it has that element of a disarmament, so to speak, on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's part. That is the bris of the keshes. So this is the approach of the Ramban. To be clear, as is seen through the psukim, the rainbow may have existed beforehand. It now attained an additional aspect as the os bris due to the things that it represents. That said, we should know that the Ibn Ezra, in fact, is of the opinion that the first rainbow to make its appearance in the world was here at the time of the bris with Noah. Zos os habris means here is a new concept which is called a rainbow, and this will be the os bris. Beforehand, there was no such thing. And in order to understand why that would be, it sounds somewhat unnatural, we need to present a bit of background. We should know that according to many Mefarshim, each one in their own way, they understand that there were decisive and traumatic effects of the world of the Mabul on the world. As if to say, what the Mabul brought about was not only significant consequences for mankind, but also for the world itself. And in fact, this is already alluded to very early in the Parsha, as far as the Sephorno is concerned, it's black on white. Let us go back to Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel, where Noach is informed that the Mabul is about to happen, or will happen. Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayemur lekim leNoach, Kate kol basar ba lefanai. It is the end of all flesh. That's what will happen. Ki malach haaretz chamas bipneihem. They're full of violence. They've just descended to a level that is beyond salvage. V'hineni mashchisam es haaretz. These are the words that I'd like to focus on. V'hineni mashchisam es haaretz. Mashchisam means to destroy. But what's interesting is, if we would not pay close attention to the words and have a free translation, presumably we would say, V'hineni mashchisam es haaretz means I'm going to destroy them from the world. Can that be said to be accurate? Of course, the problem is the word es. V'hineni mashchisam es haaretz. Now, it should have said, in terms of our translation, V'hineni mashchisam min haaretz, to destroy them from the world. The pasuk didn't say that. Now, we should know that Rashi, actually, who knows more Lashon HaKodesh than we do, explains that we didn't make a mistake. For even the word es can sometimes mean from. That's fortunate for us, otherwise that we would just be amaratzim. We're accidental, Talmidei Chachamim. Because, as Rashi says, es haaretz, kumo, it's like min haaretz. There is such an understanding of a rendition of the word es. V'domelo, an analogy to this would be ketseisi es ha'ir. The pasuk elsewhere in Tanakh, ketseisi es ha'ir, when I leave, es ha'ir really means like min ha'ir. So es ha'aretz means I'll destroy them, min ha'aretz. That's the first perush of Rashi, closest to the pshat, even though we have to adjust, so to speak, our understanding of the word es, but it's most straightforward. But Rashi gives a second perush, davar acher, es ha'aretz, the word es, which sometimes slips under the radar and isn't really translated at all. But es means with. Es is like im. And es ha'aretz means, therefore, hineni mashchisam es ha'aretz, I am now destroying them, es ha'aretz, with the earth. Now what does that mean? So Rashi explains, she'af shlosha tvachim shel omek ha'macharisha nimochu v'nitashtashu. Even like the top layer of the world, which is completely dissolved and was no more. And therefore there was a part of the world, the outer crust, three tvachim, it's not that big, that was destroyed along with the human race. And thus we understand, hineni mashchisam es haaretz, along with part of the world. The Sforno agrees in principle with Rashi's second translation that es haaretz means with the world, but he doesn't understand that it refers to the outer crust of three tvachim. He understands that there is a destruction, a significant trauma being experienced by the entire world. Es haaretz. Aretz not like motzi lechem in haaretz. Aretz meaning like the world. For on this pasuk, the Sforno says, we need to appreciate that the trauma that the world went through by being pummeled in that way from absolutely every side was the result that we take for granted now, that the world does not even revolve on an even keel. Rather, it was knocked off kilter, right, by the force of the Mabul, and it has remained so ever since. That's a chiddush. And the result of all of that are the seasons as we know them. Because once it is revolving on 22 or whatever degrees, and as it goes around the sun, so different seasons are experienced, right? There is no uniformity anymore. As far as the Sforno is concerned, prior to the Mabul, when everything was on an even keel, so those that lived around the where the Yishuv is, the center, the Mediterranean areas, was spring the whole year round. And in fact, says the Sforno, this is the meaning of the following pasuk that is said to Noah after the Mabul. Let us take a look with new eyes at the end of Perek Ches. Perek Ches, pasuk, Kaf Beis. Perek Ches, pasuk, Kaf Beis. Od kol yemei ha'aretz. For the rest of the days of the aretz. Zera, the katsir, the kor, the chom, the kayetz, the choref, the yom, the laila, lo yishbosu. Od kol yemei ha'aretz, Noach is being told, from this point on, the seasons will not stop. Now, I think we normally understand that what the pasuk means to say is that because they stopped, everything stopped for this year, but now post the Mabul, part of the bris is that everything will be restored to how it was before, and they will no longer stop as they did in this year. Everything is back to its default settings, so to speak. The Sforno says exactly the opposite. What is being introduced to Noah now is a new world order, whereby you have concepts called Kor v'Chom, Kayetz v'Chorev, summer and winter. These are new ideas. There was no such thing prior to that. But this is the way that the world looks until it reaches its final tikkun. And these changes in season, which represent also more fundamental changes, had an impact not only on the world, but on people. You find, says the Sforno, people began to live drastically shorter than they originally did. The first 10 generations, and with generations like that, people are living for 800-900 years, and that recedes quite rapidly over the following generations until it settles on a new level. People have been impacted by the way the world is now. And what's interesting is, there is a pasuk in Yeshaya which refers to two things. The first thing it refers to is Ha'aretz HaChadosha Asher Ani Oseh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, in the fullness of time, he will make new land, the new world. Now that can mean, of course, many things. But the Sforno says, Ha'aretz HaChadosha means that the world ultimately that we're looking forward to will be renewed. Renewed, that is to say, to go back to the way it was before the Mabul. That's the Aretz HaChadosha. The new land is the oldest land. And furthermore, that's in Yeshaya Perek Samach Vav. They're laying for Rosh Chodesh, after Rosh Chodesh. And in one perek earlier, Perek Samach Hei, it says, Ki hana'ar ben mea shona yomus. A young man will die at the age of 100. And the Radak explains what that means is that in the new world order, so if indeed the world will come back to be the way it originally was, so then people's lifespans will increase accordingly. To the extent that if a person would pass away at the untimely age of 100, they'd say he was a nar. He was in his teens. 100 years. But all of that has been put on hold. Od kol yemei ha'aretz, as long as the aretz remains in its present matkonet, present format, you have these chidushim called summer and winter and spring and autumn. And the question is, why would it be so? If we may ask a meta question on the Sforno. Here's the Sforno explaining the psukim. The world was pummeled and weakened. Why is that so important? And at this point, the Malbim takes over. And the Malbim explains that through many places in Chazal, we see that what really typifies the Dor HaMabul, and it, I mean, thank God, has never been repeated, certainly not with those consequences, an absolute descent into the lowest level of living. The world became a jungle. Chamas, people are grabbing from each other, they're living like animals. Part of what was responsible for that is that the natural state of the world was so potent, and there was so much natural bounty, and every physical entity was so intense, which of course gave them so much physical life. But it meant that much more was demanded of them spiritually in order to preserve a balance, to preserve a perspective. if you have such potent physical surroundings, but you're not up to par spiritually, so then it could be a disaster. Because slowly but surely, the physical side of you takes over. And the results were the beginning of Parshas Noach. Absolute tohu vavohu again. The Medrash says, just to give an example, it was in that, whether this means literally or not, I think is besides the point. It's to bring out what the world was like. It was one rainfall every 40 years was sufficient to produce a crop. In other words, the effects of the physical world were so impactful that they presented very strong forces, too strong for people to reckon with, ultimately. Not that they couldn't have, but they didn't. And when they didn't, it was the worst thing for them. There is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Chesamet Aleph, Perek Chelek, which discusses the Pasuk, which describes the Mabel. It says, Bayomahu niftechu kol arubos tehom, niftechu kol mayanos tehom rabba. All of the springs of the world, rabba, right? The great springs of the world were just opened. Of the great depth, says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, this word rabba is an interesting word. There's a certain mida keneged mida here. The rabba kilkalu. See, their ruin came through rabba. How so? At the end of Parshas Bereishis, it says, Vayar Hashem ki rabba ra'as ha'adam ba'aretz. People had gone to great evil. Barabba kilkalu, if their ruin came through rabba, Barabba nidonu, so they were judged and punished through rabba. Nivku'u kol mayanos tohom rabba. Says the Sefer Kehilas Yitzchak, it sounds almost like a gezeirah shava. Rabba, rabba, what does it mean? But rather, here the Gemara is identifying that the source of all of their descent into life as it became was rabba. In other words, they had excess of everything and they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't channel it in the correct way. And therefore, when they gave into excess, they completely lost their tzura. They lost any human faculties, or human distinction. And that was the beginning of the end for them. And therefore, barabba nidonu. And therefore, says the Malbim, we need to understand, commenting on that very same pasuk as the Sforno, that the Malbim really did two things. The first thing is that it destroyed those that needed to be destroyed. But secondly, it was a weakening. I mean, the world went through this wash. It went through this, literally this dilution, whereby the physical properties of the world have lost their potency as they used to be. As the Sforno said, people don't live so long, and with all of the other weakening of these physical phenomena. And in fact, the second aspect took much, much longer than the first. Anyone who needed to be killed, without putting too fine a point on it, probably would not have lasted in the Mabul as it was for more than a day or so. But the Mabul went on for a year. The aspect of diluting the world and reducing the potency of the physical world took much longer, took a year. And what's interesting is, looked at in this way, we'll appreciate that there is the bris that happens, the covenant after the Mabul, is twofold. Actually, we will see there is a bris between Hashem and Noach, meaning between Hashem and mankind, and there's a bris between Hashem and the world. And actually, both of them are referred to. Let's take a look in Perek Tes, Pasuk Yud Aleph. And these psukim with regard in the parsha of the rainbow are very difficult. There seems to be a number of repetitions, and they need to be really considered very carefully. Pasuk Yud Aleph says, "Vahakim osias brisi etchem." I am now maintaining my bris with you. "Velo yikareis kol basa od mimei hamabul," and mankind will no longer be wiped out from the mabul. "Velo ye od mabul l'shachesaris," there won't be another mabul. Now, if we just read that pasuk carefully and slowly, it's a difficult pasuk. because it's saying that, well, it seems to be saying two things, but they're not two things. The first thing is, there's two points on the agenda. Number one, people will never again be wiped out by a marble. Number two, there will never again be a marble. If there will never again be a marble, so then people can't get wiped out. One could have, so to speak, just gone to the end of the pasuk, and if there will never be a marble, so then there's not what to get wiped out with. But the pasuk splits it into two. It says the malbim, because there are two aspects to the pasuk. There are two aspects to the bris. Number one is a bris between Hashem and mankind. They will no longer be wiped out through a marble. But number two, even if they're not wiped out, because maybe they could survive a marble, Hashem will never again bring a marble that will destroy the world. That's between him and the world, so to speak. The world will never undergo another one of these downgrading in terms of its assets and its potency. Those are two separate things. Pasuk Yud Gimel. If you have a pasuk referring to a bris between Hashem and the world, before you get to the pasuk in pasuk Tet Zayin, Tesvav, there's a bris between me and you, says Hashem, and between me and the world. They're two separate parts of the bris. Says the Malbim, it is entirely possible that prior to the Mabul, especially, I mean, we're mindful of the way that the Medrash has described for us what rainfall looked like. Once every few years, it could be 40 years or whatever, enough rain came down and that was that. If everything was so all-encompassing, if everything was so powerful, it may well be that when the rain came, it came in a pre-Mabul capacity, which means that the rain came full on. When it finally came, it came with everything. The entire world was clouded over, or the entire area was clouded over, and the clouds themselves were thick with water. These two things can have a major impact on whether or not a rainbow can be seen. A rainbow can only be seen if part of the sky is not clouded over. That's the part that the sunlight needs to come through. And there is only a certain consistency, or a certain, shall we say, concentration of water that will allow the light of the sun to be refracted through it. A thick cloud will never host a rainbow. And therefore, says Malbim, it may very well be that the rain as it used to fall in this pre-Mabul way didn't allow for a rainbow to be seen through it. And on the contrary, that's why the rainbow is such an ideal Os Baris. Because the Os Baris is basically, literally, a sign of the way things are now. The very fact that you can see a rainbow now is a sign of the fact that the world has been weakened. And now when rain comes, it doesn't come in that full-on type of way. There's room for a rainbow. And that is the status quo as it will be. That's part of the Bris, and that's the Os Baris. We should note, and this, of course, is all the Malbim really representing the side of the Ibn Ezra, not like the Ramban, who says that this may well have been the first rainbow, for reasons, as he explains. We should note that perhaps there is support for the position of the Ibn Ezra from a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. For the Mishnah states in Perek Hay, Asara Dvarim Nivru Erev Shabbos Bein Hashmoshos. There were 10 things that were created just in twilight, just before Shabbos came in. On that list is the rainbow. Now, the Sefer Shari Aaron makes a very good point. All of those things have the following in common. Each one was necessary at a certain time, and that was when it was introduced to the world. The mouth of the Bilam's donkey, and Kivur Shel Moshe, and all of these things. The Mateh, all of these things. According to the Ramban, there were always rainbows around. They just didn't have the meaning of the Os Baris until the Mabul happened, and all of a sudden, when you look at a rainbow, it means something else now. But if that's true, then it's not really like the other things on the list. the Mishnah seems to be more supportive of the approach of the Ibn Ezra, that the rainbow, like everything else, came actually into the world at a certain key point, namely after the rainbow. That's a very interesting he'ara. Now, if I may use the expression, in light of all of this, we need to now consider something else about the rainbow. Namely, the Gemara tells us, and the Medrash tells us, that there were certain unique individuals who were at the helm of their generation, which was typified by the fact that a rainbow was never seen during their days. That was considered to be the mark of a real top-level tzaddik. A rainbow wasn't seen during their days. Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Anshei Knesset HaGedola. I mean, these are the ones that are mentioned by Chazal. Of course, our question will now be in the reverse. If indeed, according to both approaches, whether it's the Ramban or Ibn Ezra, the rainbow is a natural phenomenon now, then what would it mean for it not to appear? Presumably it rained, and presumably the sun shone, and when the two go together, the world being what it is, a rainbow will appear. It's very nice if a rainbow wouldn't appear, but why would it not? It could be, the linear response is that if there's anything supernatural about a rainbow, it's not that it appears, which is a very natural thing, but that it didn't appear during their times, even though it should have. That may well be. But there's a fascinating answer to this question, or explanation of this statement in the Gemara, which is to be found in a sefer called Toras Ha'ola. The Toras Ha'ola is a sefer that was written by the Ramah. And it deals with the Beis HaMikdash and Korbanos in an exhaustive and fascinating way. He is the Ramah. And he comes, of course, Bidarko, to talk about many things. And he talks about this Gemara that says that there were certain people that the hallmark of their status and of their generation is that a rainbow was never seen. Where would it go? Says the Ramah, the explanation is very simple. In the beginning of Parshas Bichukosai, when the Torah speaks about the Jewish people as they should be, so there are a number of brachas, and one of the brachas is V'nosati gishmeichem bi'ito. Hashem says the rain will come in its time. Now the question is, when is its time? Does that mean seasonally? And Rashi quotes from the Toras Kohanim that bi'ito means there are certain times which are ideal for the rain to come, and certain times which are inconvenient. And the special bracha is, of course, first and foremost, the rain is a bracha, but rain at a convenient time is just a super bracha. When is the most convenient time for rain to fall? Says Rashi, Leile Shabbosos, Friday night. Everyone's home, no one's going anywhere, no one's traveling anywhere, no one will be inconvenienced. Leile Shabbosos. Says the Ramah, when the Gemara says that these individuals and their generation was a righteous generation and therefore the rainbow is never seen, nature was not suspended for their behalf. Rather, they were deserving of the bracha of Nasati Kishmechem Be'itam. And if the rain fell at the convenient time of Friday night, so one thing you do need in order to have a rain, that's sunlight. But if the rain comes at the convenient time of Leile Shabbosos, and by the time you wake on Shabbos morning, it's finished, so then it's a symptom of the bracha of Nasati Kishmechem Be'itam that a rainbow was never seen in their time. That's a very interesting answer from the Ramah. There is a further insight into these individuals who never saw the rainbow. I heard this many years ago from my father, Zatzal, and subsequently saw it. It's from the name of Rav Meir Shapira. Noach is a very complicated person, and there's a lot of things said about him that one would not have expected to be said. And the first thing relates to how the parsha introduces him. He's Noach, Ish Tzadik, Tomim Hayabudarosa. You'd never imagine anything was amiss until, before you know it, Rashi quotes from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, there's a machlokus as to whether, does that mean in a positive way or in a negative way? It means to compare him with other generations. In other generations, he would have been better or worse. And before we know it, it's a hotly contested issue. And some of the Rish Lignai. Some say that it means to reflect to a certain degree negatively. Comparing with Avram, he wouldn't have been considered such a tzaddik. That's mild, actually. Rashi says he wouldn't have been klum. The Medrash also compares him in that way to Moshe and Shmuel, Bereishis Rabbah. If he would have been the generation of Moshe and Shmuel, he wouldn't have been considered a tzaddik. So, it's very interesting. We're clearly meant to learn something from this. And those three examples are also very telling. And they're three very specific people. And what does this mean? It says, Rav Meir Shapira, Noach is criticized for not having extended himself sufficiently to help the people in his generation. Not to try and be Makar of them, or, I mean, he built the ark. But no one came. And the question is, why not? Says Rav Meir Shapira, I understand him. I can understand Noach. The more you find out about the generation at the time of Noach, but they are the Dor HaMabul. They are the generation that deserves for the entirety of mankind to be wiped out, the less encouraged you become. It's possible to understand, al derech hateva, that Noach reached a point that he gave up. Perhaps they've just crossed the point of no return. They're beyond salvage. Now, that wasn't correct, but it's understandable. We give up on people much, much earlier than that. So, is there an answer to that question? Says Rav Meir Shapira, yes, the answer comes in the form of three people. Three people who didn't give up when they could equally have been expected to. Life as Avram Avinu meets it is roughly analogous to life as Noach meets it. Asara Doros mi Adam ad Noach. Or the parallel is Asara Doros mi Noach ad Avram. And they're all called Machisim Uvoyim. They're all called getting worse and worse. But Avram rises to the challenge. He engages. He enlists a movement. He brings people around, spreads the word. He puts himself out for people that you think it's a mitzvah to give up on them. The people of Sodom. To this day, it's difficult to understand why he davened to them. But he did. Because maybe they can still be helped. The longest conversation that we have from Avram in the entire Torah is his negotiations with HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the people of Sodom. It's unbelievable. Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jewish people, he has been officially told the Jewish people are condemned to be destroyed by God. Hanichali, leave me alone, I'm going to destroy them, you will become the new Jewish people. That's the time that if there's ever a time to give up with religious sanction, it's that. Moshe, not giving up. Vayechal Moshe, mecheni na misifrecho. Shmuel doesn't live at home. Shmuel spent the entire year on the road, making sure that everyone, however far away they would be, if he can help them in their Dinei Torah, and help them in their Torah study, he came home once a year. Uchuvoso haramoso kishon beso. Says Rav Meir Shapira, it is in this regard that Noach is held wanting relative to these other generations. He himself was a tzaddik. We should never forget. If the Torah calls him a tzaddik, once again, you know, mikuzokt. The Torah says a tzaddik, he's a tzaddik. If he is compared negatively to others, it's in this respect that he did not have that interaction with his nation, and they did. Says Rav Meir Shapira, a most fascinating comment. Noach was saved because he's a tzaddik. And there is a sign that the Mabul will never happen again. But the sign is also a reminder for Noach. Because actually a rainbow is the last thing that you'd expect. When the sky has been overcast and everything darkens and it looks like the end, but if the sun just persists enough and shines through, something actually comes out which really is a combination of those two. There's a new thing altogether. That's the Os Baris. That's the rainbow. It's a reminder for Noah. Everything clouded over in Noah's generation. But he should have kept on pushing through. He was saved. But that's the reminder. And these generations, as Rav Meir Shapira, those special generations, they were basically people who caused revolutions. Chizkiyahu HaMelech, and we don't know that much about him because we don't learn that much about him, but he revolutionized the state of the Jewish people in his time. He was the son of an idol worshiper. And he instituted a nationwide program of Torah learning and Torah observance, Dorei Chizkiah. It was almost the times of Mashiach. If he had just followed the natural track, he would have given up. Rabbi Shua ben Levi. The Gemara says about Rabbi Shua ben Levi, he made a point of learning Torah with people that no one else would go near. He used to visit colonies of people that had these diseases that were contagious and no one wanted to have anything to do with them. Rabbi Shua ben Levi says, I can't give up on them. Who's going to teach them Torah? And he endangered himself. He was Moser Nefesh to teach them Torah. And Shekneses HaGedola, the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, which sounds nice, looked like a tragedy. The Jewish people limped back to Eretz Yisrael, some of them. No one knew anything. Many of them intermarried. The leadership at the helm could take one look at them and run for the hills. Or retreat into the base of Medrash. And the Anshei Knesset HaGedola took them on and turned them around. They're the ones who said, Hamidu Tamidim Harbe, spread Torah wherever you can. They gave them a siddur, they gave them tefillas, they gave them brachas. And reconstructed the Jewish people. Rehabilitated them. Reb Shimon ben Yochai, the generation after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Says the Meir Shapira, when the Gemara says that the rainbow was not seen during the generations of these people, is because they didn't need to see it. Because they were the rainbow. They persisted. They didn't need that reminder. That was the special quality of these people. I used to be very hesitant talking about this aspect of Noach, Ish Dorsh and Lignai. I felt uncomfortable. Because it's not nice to say not nice things about people. But in recent years, I think the exact opposite is true. It's Chazal talk about it, it's because we need to talk about it. Not to gloat over the shortcomings of Noach, but to see whether we've learned anything from him. Because we're also surrounded by certain people that... if we give up on them, so then we're worse than Noah, because we didn't even learn from him. He didn't have anyone to learn from. So it's on the contrary, the Dorish Lignai is a challenge to us. That's really one of the major lessons of Parshas Noah. I'd like to just spend the last few moments briefly taking a look at another very mystifying Parsha, which is the vineyard of Noah. To summarize it, if we could, Noah, he plants a vineyard, and he drinks from the wine, becomes inebriated, becomes exposed in his tent. Ham sees it, tells the others, they cover him over, and Ham is cursed, and they're blessed. And Ham is cursed with servitude. Eved avodim yelech. V'kol ha'parsha zos omeres darsheni. What exactly is happening here? Ham's behavior, it seems to be childish, actually. If just read the psukim literally. Here's Noach, and Ham, he sees him, and he goes inside and tells his brothers. I mean, it sounds like a thing a child would do. He's not a child. He's 100 years old. Says Rav Hirsch, what's happening here is a decisive moment for Ham. Ham, we know, was the wayward son of the three. He wasn't always with the program, but it's difficult. I mean, if a father like Noach, and Noach is an Ish Tzaddik, it's a little bit difficult to really do what you want. Until he finds Noach in a moment of weakness. This is a point that can be liberating for Ham. Until now, his father has a hold on him. His father has a moral hold on him. He's his father. Leads by example. Difficult for Ham to answer that. But on that day, he found his answer. The answer is he found that he had seen the true Noah. The one who also has no self-control. The one who also is able to descend into a degrading state. And for Ham, this was a watershed for him. When it says that he saw Ervas Aviv, Erva we know, aside from literally meaning nakedness, means weakness. Yosef accuses the brothers, Meraglim Atem. Leroy says, Ervas Haoretz Basem. You've come to see the weak point. Ham was delighted to have discovered the weak point of Noah, because it finally freed him from those shackles of having to see Noah as someone that he needed to answer to. From this point onwards, if Noah ever gives him reproof, Ham knows which episode to bring up. And for him, it's a defining episode for Noah. Shem and Yefes understand that they have a certain responsibility. They're not looking to free themselves from their relationship with Noah. They cannot ignore what's happened here. But the question is, who is the real Noah? The Noah who's been a tzaddik for the last 600 years, or the Noah who drank too much now? And if the one who is exposed in his tent is not the real Noah, you need to cover him. He needs that dignity, because he may have had a lapse, but that doesn't define him. It doesn't turn wrong into right, but that is not Noah. And therefore they refuse to look at him, and they cover him over, because their relationship with Noah, they don't wish to throw it away, because if they throw that relationship away, they're really throwing their own future away. And in fact, when Noah wakes up, takes stock of what's happened, he gives them those brachas, those outstanding brachas, Yaftalukim leYefes, V'yishkon Be'or leShem, meaning you have a future. The reason why you have a future is because you have a respect for your past, because you have a relationship of someone that you're looking to aspire to be like someone higher than you. And if you do that, you will succeed. Ham is cursed with servitude. And the reason why is because there is a very difficult mido keneged mido here. He sought to free himself from Noach by telling the brothers about this. But Rav Hirsch says, if he frees himself from any form of moral enclosure or moral framework, he will end up being a bigger Eved than anyone else. Because if he has no self-control, he will become a slave to every force that exists inside of him and outside of him. And therefore, he is called Eved Avodim. That's what's waiting for him. And what's fascinating is, the Pasuk says, Pasuk Kafbeis of Perek Teth, Vayar Cham Avi Kanan Es Ervas Aviv. Cham, the father of Canaan, he saw the erva of his father, and he told his brother. Why does the Pasuk here make a point of telling me that Cham is the father of Canaan? So we should know that it's well known, Rashi tells us from the Medrash, that for the year in the Teva, marital relations was not allowed, not between Noah and his wife, and not between the sons and their wives. The world was in a state of destruction, and it was considered inappropriate, and everything just kind of went on hold. However, the Medrash tells us that Ham disregarded that, and he actually was involved with his wife. And moreover, there are a number of Mefarshim who say that Canaan was actually born in the Teva. He was born before the year was out. He was a Teva baby. And in fact, that, if we have a look at the Pasuk, Yudches, Perek Tes Pasuk Yudches, Vayuvenei Noach Hayotze Min HaTeva, Shem, Cham, Vayofes, those were the three, V'cham, Hu Avi Canaan. Cham is the father of Canaan. Say the Mefarshim, that means Cham left the Teva as the father of Canaan. They went in 8, came out 9. So now, what's interesting is that the Pasuk is highlighting. Ham is looking to break ties with his father. He doesn't want to have his father to have a hold on him. So the Pasuk is saying, what's so amazing about this is that he had that relationship with his father while he himself already had a son. People tend to sober up a little bit in terms of their relationship with their parents when they have their own children. Because just with a bit of foresight, you understand that the way that you relate to your parents will hopefully set a precedent for how your children relate to you. And if you don't have children yet, so then the world is your oyster. But once there's another generation exists, so you look at things differently. Because every time there's something that you say to your parent, you think, well, would I want my child to say that to me? Ham is the first of Noah's sons to become a parent. And even so, he completely disregarded his relationship with his own father, not thinking even just that 5 minutes into the future, so how will your son relate to you? And who is his son? His son is Canaan. Says Rav Hirsch, Minayin, where it came from. Canaan went on to become one of the most corrupt nations. And this is where it started. And what's interesting is, when we read Parshas Noach, so we're starting the Chumash from the beginning. So we start as if we don't know anything until we find it out. But the generation that receives the Torah, they know, they're living in the Torah. And they are living through Chumash Shemos. Which means that when they read Parshas Bereishis, they already know Chumash Shemos, because they are Chumash Shemos. When they read about Canaan, they know about Canaan. Canaan is the nation they are a matter of weeks away from confronting, things being what they are there. So it's most fascinating to consider that when they read about Canaan, it's not like how we read about Canaan in a linear fashion, that so far there's this individual called Canaan, and who knows what will become of him. They've met what became of him. That nation is waiting for them a few kilometers down the road. And the Torah talks to them about Canaan. Canaan is the worst of the worst. K'maasei Eretz Canaan lo ta'asu. Be sure never to emulate anything about Canaan, because you need to know what type of people they are. So when the Torah teaches Parshas Noach to the generation that receives the Torah, it lets them know where it all came from. What type of moral fortitude could they have if there was a successive disintegration of any form of communication or aspiration between from parent to child? So X generations down the line, you reach the bottom of the barrel. That's Canaan, as they were. So these are important yesodas to be aware of, especially in our time, of course, Ikvazid de Mashiach, the time just before the Mashiach, where the Mishnah tells us there will be a complete role reversal in terms of parents and children. Children will no longer look up to their parents. Parents will look up to the children. That's the state things will reach. Zekeinim b'pnei na'ar yokumu. The old will get up in front of the young, meaning they'll look to them for guidance. They'll look to them for what's the latest in whatever it may be. And all of that means that there's very little chance for the next generation. What can they aspire to? Their only one aspiration is negative, not to be like their parents. The result is the world as we have it. And we're looking to get back to our Aretz HaChadosha through learning the lessons from these parshas.